We must speak the truth about terror. Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories, malicious lies that attempt to shift the blame away from the terrorists themselves.
Take your own advice.
What happens? I tell you what happens. Blam!
I have a window that looks directly at the World Trade Center, and I saw...
No delusion!
Shit's getting way too complicated for me.
Jerry, find your head, be present.
Welcome to The Antidote. This is Greg McCarron.
And this is Jeremy Rothkuchel.
All right, it is Tuesday, August 8th, 2023, and we're going to get back into American Kompromat by Craig Unger as we get into the topic of Jeffrey Epstein, Donald Trump, and John Mark Dugan. We're going to get back into our previous reading where we left off, I believe, at the end of page 223 of American Kompromat by Craig Unger.
All right, yes, but very bottom of page 223, and, you know, a lot has happened between our last recording on this topic and now, including, you know, another and the most major maybe indictment of Donald Trump by Jack Smith that fits into the background from when we were recording shows about 7 days in November in relationship to what was all going on after the immediate days after the 2020 election into January 6th as, you know, as a backup plan for what now has been termed, I believe, related to conspiracy to defraud the United States in terms of Trump's role in this, along with six unnamed co-conspirators, many to most of whom are different lawyers and lawyer types. And so there's that. There's also disclosed documents surrounding the JFK assassination that point to probably an interstitial spy of some sort of Eastern European background, a Jewish guy who connected deeply with James Angleton in relationship to U.S. counterintelligence, and then a deep relationship with Israel, which then begins to solidify aspects of the hypothesis surrounding, first of all, Angleton at the epicenter of the setup and the operation, and then the cover-up of the Kennedy assassination, and then Angleton's role sitting there at the Israel desk, and then, as we pointed out, the suspicion surrounding him in relationship to his ties to notorious Soviet spy Kim Philby, and that whole scenario that Angleton allegedly missed for many, many years while he was, you know, looking for other Russian penetrations. So that has come out. And then we are also now in between the anniversaries, the memorials of the dropping of atomic bombs by the United States on Japan. We're now between Hiroshima, which was August 6th, and then August 9th, Nagasaki, with the Christopher Nolan film Oppenheimer having recently come out and become a big hit, and dealing some of with that topic, and so there's a lot there in the both in terms of considering the background of the nuclear age, the Cold War. Have nuclear weapons only been deployed that one time? Are we now in the age of covert use of tactical nuclear weapons, especially with an escalation in the post 9/11 world where they are, quote unquote, plausibly denied having been used? What did that exactly have to do with 9/11 itself? And then what we've seen in a whole series of, quote unquote, terrorist bombings in those days. And so is the threat of nuclear engagement, putting aside the question of Russia, Ukraine, and all of that goes surrounding that in terms of what are said to be the threats of nuclear escalation there. But I would assert the question of the ongoing deployment in an overtly covert denied fashion of tactical nukes to this day, it looks like. So those things are, you know, have all sort of, you know, taken place in relationship to our last recording around Trump, Kompromat, Dugin, Epstein Maxwell, who has the Kompromat. And just one last thing I'll say in terms of relating to that is that there is this whole aspect that is really not much touched upon in the Oppenheimer film of the deep espionage background in terms of the rise of American rocketry, Caltech, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory over there in Pasadena, in the hills of Pasadena. The Unit 122 Soviet spy cell set up at a house close to Caltech, where some of the founders of not only U.S. rocketry program, but also Chinese and Soviet rocketry program were all present at the time. And also who was present was one of the Talpiot twin Maxwell sisters' father-in-law, Frank Molina. Whose son is Roger Molina, who I believe is married to, I believe, Isabel Maxwell. So there's a lot going on in the background here that ties in, I would say. And then when you talk about the conjunction of the cyber is the new domain of power. What was the old domain of power? Why was there such tension between President John Kennedy and Ben-Gurion in relationship to the question of the Israeli nuclear bomb? Is because in the quote-unquote old domain of power, it was the nuclear umbrella, nuclear weaponry was the major power player, real political power player geopolitically. And I don't believe that age has totally ended. It has gone more covert, and it has become way more of questions of intelligence, counterintelligence, espionage, but then now the rise of cyber power as this new sort of nuclear level threat and power domain that the Prime Minister Netanyahu talked about as the new domain of power. So I think this is all plays into the question of counterintelligence, compromise. How does compromising video and audio get passed around? How is it accessed? How is it hidden? How is it deployed without being publicly deployed? Those kinds of things. So that's why we continue to hunt down this line of who has the Epstein-Maxwell Kompromat audiovisual data that's still lingering in the background and that has been replaced with, in some part, a red herring of client lists and who was on the plane.
For sure, and thank you for bringing those in. And I'll add two more quick things that took place since the last time we recorded in the tail end of July, and they're both interrelated to this topic. One is Benjamin Netanyahu being interviewed on CNN by Wolf Blitzer. Wolf Blitzer is kind of notorious within certain circles as a former, basically, spokesperson, employee, whatever term you want to use, of AIPAC, and seeing a prime minister of Israel having a professional but not friendly, pretty hostile, pretty combative, professional but combative interview with Wolf Blitzer, having that type of interview with the prime minister of Israel was probably unthinkable just a few years ago. I mean, and seeing that now, like, this is the, for me, maybe one of the most glaring signs yet that, like, this relationship is not going well. And it's one thing when it's Judy Woodruff or Chuck Todd or Fareed Zakaria, but then it's another thing when it's Wolf Blitzer, a guy who, like, is known for his advocacy of Israel through actually being employed by AIPAC. And so that was pretty incredible to see, I thought. And I'll post a link to that in our show notes. And then also, you mentioned John F. Kennedy. I'd be remiss not to mention Robert F. Kennedy Jr., basically. You know, we've been talking about this trend for a while now, but, you know, he's linked himself up with Rabbi Shmuley and did this, is now basically rhetorically coming off sounding like maybe the most like rabidly pro-Zionist presidential candidate of any major party we've ever seen. I mean, there might be a few other candidates, but, like, as far as, like, major party candidates out right now, like, and, you know, you've got Trump and you've got DeSantis out there and all these other people, but, like, he's just I mean, you had made the comment that he's reciting these talking points more effectively and more blatantly than pretty much anybody we've seen in this type of, and this morph continues as he went on did the Jimmy Dore show and was just pushing talking point after talking point after talking point. And it's pretty pretty amazing. That also ties in with like this this whole that strange dynamic around the 1488 tweet regarding Secret Service protection. The name escaped me there for a second. And there's a lot of strange things happening there, but like he's gone from just like you know, saying things that are friendly to Israel and to now like just you know, Zionist Organization of America. Rabbi Shmuley makes AIPAC look pretty dovish in comparison. I mean, in terms of Zionism and their rabid advocacy for Israel, for particularly for right-wing Likud type policies, and then also even going back on story of Sirhan, and this is a yeah, this is quite the development to see play out. I just wanted to add those in there as things that are going on right now as well since the last time I recorded.
Yes, and a lot of this is not that quote-unquote weird because, except for those who have not yet really sort of followed on with the analysis that, for example, that we were doing in terms of the way that the quote-unquote alt-light and alt-right were both being deployed in a narrative warfare fashion in ways that definitely served the Netanyahu Zionists, and in a long form fashion, as we, you know, continue to point out, the hardline Jabotinsky quote unquote revisionist political Zionists, in terms of and many of just the Zionist founders in general, talking about how anti-Semites will be our best friend. Okay, this is not that complicated in terms of someone like RFK Jr., where he's both, you know, at least his milieu or his communications are dabbling in 4chan type memes and white nationalist sort of anti, quote unquote, anti-Jewish memes of 1488 in terms of their public tweets, while also being the most obvious, quote unquote, pro-Zionist talking point deploying candidate that we've seen. And it's definitely the case. RFK Jr. is like, he knows a lot of the central, long-term and current Israeli state propaganda talking points. Some of the talking points are gray propaganda in that they use facts to skew reality. And some are just really black propaganda and false, you know, disinformation and false tellings of history and false tellings of the current moment, and all in general serve to stave people's attention away from deep politics, the question of Zionist involvement in assassinations, including of RFK Jr.'s you know, father and uncle, and then also the even bigger question of the long, decades long architecture of a terror war, a global terror war, war on terrorism, 9/11, all of that. That includes then clean break wars, includes Oded Yanon as a strategy, you know, to quote unquote secure, expand and secure the realm through divide and conquer, and the long term, now increasingly overt history of Zionist terrorism that includes against Jews in Muslim and predominantly Muslim and or Arab countries to drive them to Israel. All right. So this is, you know, right in line with all of that kind of history and analysis. And it's only those who are not paying attention who can't understand what's happening at this point, I would say. So.
Well, that, yeah, that's a good point. And I guess it's not so much, it's not strange. You're right about that. But it's still always, to me, it's still always a little crazy to see these things like play out, even if you can like see certain trends out there. It's still like, you know, still to see them actually play out in real time is always, always to me at least, a sight to behold. Now, I'll mention one last thing, and then we'll get into the book, get back into American Compromise. But our friend and colleague John Swin is beginning to go back. At least we were having a conversation recently, and he's starting to go back into the history of of Joseph P. Kennedy, the Kennedy family patriarch, and his attitudes towards towards Jewish issues, towards the Second World War, the America First movement. So there's a lot there, and the relationships, you know, the father and then the sons, and then Robert Kennedy Jr. years later. So I find it interesting that John's had his somewhat of his mindset in that direction, and what may potentially come out of that in terms of research or insight, be interesting to see going forward.
Yeah. And once again, even with the RFK Jr. issue, the question of Russia and Israel specifically are often used as these sort of polar point pinchers moves, one to obscure the other in many spheres. And so one other thing that's recently happened is it's been declared that it looks like Charles McGonigal, the very blatantly compromised former head of New York FBI counterintelligence at key moments, was being paid, you know, had been then eventually paid directly by this key, Putin-associated Russian oligarch, Oleg Deripaska, who was also the one in behind the deep debt of Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort. And so I believe that McGonigal is now said to, he's going to be pleading guilty in relationship to at least some of these charges. And so people might want to then return to the scene of the crime domestically in terms of the 11/9 operation, and then what has been disparaged as Russiagate conspiracy theories by all of these kinds of people that RFK Jr. especially had some sway with before he went so pro-Israel to in some eyes. So Jimmy Dore, that's where they agree with RFK Jr., is that RFK Jr. found the light based on what we've talked about before, RFK Jr. disclosing to Glenn Greenwald that it was Oliver Stone and his son Sean Stone that changed his mind on quote-unquote Russiagate.
And Jimmy Dore, the desire to keep this definitely within the family, quote unquote, when it comes to this Russia-Israel factor, by proposing that RFK Jr. debate Max Blumenthal about Israel-Palestine. And I guess ultimately it's not going to happen, I guess, because as a presidential candidate, Kennedy Jr. is not going to, I guess, participate in that kind of debate. But like, that was the proposal, and that would very much be keeping it in the family, so to speak, within these factors of Israel and Russia and one and the other and all that.
It looks like that maybe that RFK Jr. is now publicly bucking his communication staff, and he will do it with Max Blumenthal. Mm-hmm. That's the last thing I think that came out in that sphere. And so that's all part of the public relations too of RFK Jr. as this, you know, fearless candidate who will buck his own team to, you know, counter his critics. But of course, as you just pointed out again, these are critics not on the question of the 11/9 operation, let alone the 9/11 operation, which of course all of these groups, including RFK Jr., are total, I'd say, disinformationists on, cover-up artists on, but definitely on the question of what they call Russiagate. And Blumenthal, you know, is a pretty good scholar and journalist when it comes to knocking down a lot of RFK Jr.'s Israeli-sponsored propaganda, both historically and present day. But as we pointed out before, these kinds of disagreements or debates, whether, you know, from, or it seems similar to something like RFK Jr. versus Dershowitz around COVID, where the payload once again seemed in that case to be the covering up of 11/9 and all of that. So this is, we're just sort of seeing the same thing play out in a similar kind of way that we early identified. RFK Jr. looks to be some kind of Tulsi Gabbard for 2024, and playing a very specific role that is obviously very friendly to the 11/9 operators themselves, such as the Bannons and the Roger Stone type. So,
yeah, you're right. And ultimately, Blumenthal being an effective spokesperson. I mean, before, you know, we've talked in a positive way about some of his work documenting the situation elements of the Palestinian crisis, maybe the domestic situation on the ground in some of these areas. having somebody in an effective position like that to talk that way, especially someone who, you know, is media trained, comes from a prominent family, Sid Blumenthal's all kinds of questions about where his loyalties may or may not ultimately lie. But having that also, it makes it, that increases the effectiveness while also staying away from like what you just talked about, the deep political aspects of things going on beyond just the occupation and the U.S. special relationship being the reason why all these things are taking place, though.
All right. Well, with that long preamble in place there, that I believe is resonant with the reasons for the potential continuing importance of this inquiry of American Compromise by Craig Unger, how the KGB cultivated Donald Trump and related tales of sex, greed, power, and treachery, we will return to the text, page 223. And maybe what I'll do is I'll just reread the last paragraph that we ended on last time that came down to these two main points in this history of John Dugan encountering Detective Joseph Ricari, who then, fairly in recent years suffered in a fairly young death, I think in his 50s, from an unnamed quick illness of some sort. But then the pre-existing presence of this dumping operation, this dumping ground by Dugan that in some way is aligns or is parallel with the rise of mass scale leaking and dumping operations surrounding things like Assange and WikiLeaks, or even Snowden, sort of a more in between. But last time we pointed out the difference between mass dumping and leaking, especially in relationship to the question of journalism and public interest sense making than actual whistleblowing. So we will get back to that. All right, page bottom half of page 223 of American Compromise by Craig Unger. Quote, as the founder of PBSOtalk.org, Dugan often got requests like that. Quote, I just became the guy who everybody used to give stuff to. Everybody knew that I designed the system to keep everybody absolutely confidential, and the sheriff hated it. So people would give me things like a deposition where the sheriff got caught stealing a gun from the evidence room. I was like the dumping ground for stuff, unquote. So, Dugan says, Ricari came over to his office on Olive Avenue in Palm Beach with a cart full of boxes. Quote, one of the boxes was a bunch of DVDs, the blank kind that you record your own media on, Dugan recalled. They were labeled by date and spanned from 1994 to 2005 or so. I asked Ricari what they were, and he told me they were concerning Jeffrey Epstein, but he didn't elaborate about the contents, unquote. And I just want to point out the dates, right? So 1994, we're talking about that is the year of the alleged Katie Johnson abuse and rapes that were delineated in, especially in her second filed civil suit in New York in the immediate months before the 2016 election, right? So the 1994 is included, and then on into 2005. It's a crucial decade, right? It spans from the Clinton years and Epstein's involvement in the Clinton White House, on into the George W. Bush post 9/11 years, with all of the chatter I'll continue to remind folks of, that, Jeffrey Epstein and his plane and his Teterboro airport access might have even been involved in material involved in, at the very least, the Ground Zero Lower Manhattan part of the 9/11 operation. So this is a crucial decade, a little bit more than a decade of material. Now, we don't know, as I think we pointed out last time, whether this is just Florida material or whether there was some kind of networked linkage of the different Epstein properties, all of which it looks like had some kind of form of audiovisual recording and compromise material production involved. So,
and this is also the period between 1994, the Katie Johnson incident, and then when the event was happened in 1994, as testified by Johnson. And then 2005, I believe, is the date of when the falling out between Trump and Epstein took place. We ultimately learned that it was over a prized piece of real estate that was ultimately purchased by Dmitry Rybolovlev. So that's, I think that encompasses that time period. The period between the events that were said to go down with Katie Johnson and then the falling out over real estate property.
And then Dmitry Rybolovlev then makes another major appearance in relationship to the 2016 elections and the 11-9 operation, more than 10 years after the question of the real estate and Epstein-Trump fallouts. And Rybolovlev is a Russian sphere fertilizer king, billionaire oligarch, and also then his private jet appeared to be miming or following, was almost like a tail or a parallel stalking horse of some sort in relationship to the Trump campaign in 2016.
Yeah, just before what we call 11-9, just within days of that.
All right, bottom of page 223 of American Compromat by Craig Unger. Quote, according to Dugin, Ricchieri said his investigation was being sabotaged by both Epstein and his powerful allies, and he wanted to make sure he had copies in case they tried to make the originals disappear. After all, they had to know the kind of evidence Ricchieri had assembled. Ricchieri's fears were also reported in the Miami Herald by Julie K. Brown and David Smiley in an article noting that Epstein had hired investigators to tail both Ricchieri and Chief Ryder. Ricchieri said that he often switched vehicles in an attempt to throw Epstein's team off. Quote, at some point, it became like a cat and mouse game, he told the Herald. I knew they were there, and they knew I knew they were there. I was concerned about my kids because I didn't know if it was someone that they hired just out of prison that would hurt me or my family, unquote. In May 2018, shortly after his interview by the Herald, Ricchieri, then 50, died after a brief illness. In the meantime, according to a report by Kevin Polson of the Daily Beast, Dugin's website continued to publish dirt about Palm Beach's finest. Some of it was true, some of it was not. There was the story of the former SWAT commander who was accused of, quote, stealing painkillers from a dying deputy, purchase orders showing the office spent nearly $80,000 on barbecue grills, a photo of officers posing with a topless woman on a Palm Beach golf course, unquote. But he also published loads of disinformation and accusations about Sheriff Rick Bradshaw and other PBSO brass, including a fake pedophilia confession that appeared under the fraudulent byline of a top department official. Meanwhile, Dugin had struck up an online relationship with a Russian woman on Facebook. It was the beginning of a virtual romance that he hoped to transform into a real one. So, in February 2013, he went to Moscow for the first time. Dugin loved Moscow immediately, citing its sense of ungoverned freedom. Quote, it was like the Wild West meets New York City, unquote, he said. Full unquote. And by the way, remember 2013? Key year for another 11-9 operator, Michael Flynn. It wasn't that the year Michael Flynn actually went to Russian military intelligence headquarters. Apparently the highest level American official to ever be brought into Russian military intelligence headquarters.
Yes, and I believe Jim Stewartson's done some, and his network have connected some dots regarding some specific time frame of events and how they match up with in terms of Flynn at GRU and even the Edward Snowden and things like that. So just throw that in there. And then also, you know, I just think about all these people, whether it's, you know, whether it's John Mark Dugin or whether it's Scott Ritter or whether apparently it's Michael Maloof, just these, you know, they got these key figures. They end up with these Russian spouses. It happens in so many cases.
Very interesting. but not weird at all. Fully in line with the deep history of intelligence operations, way beyond even modern history.
You can't point this out. You point this out, you're a Russophobe. Meanwhile, it's perfectly normal and natural to and logical to put a Star of David around every single Biden appointee who happens to be of a certain ethnic background.
Yep. All right, back to the text, bottom of page 224 of American Kompromat by Craig Unger. Quote, as for the romance, he told me he has not seen nor communicated with the woman in several years, and he declined to reveal her name. About a week after he arrived in Moscow, Dugin posted a photo on his Facebook page of himself having lunch at the Bison Steakhouse in Moscow with an unusually intriguing companion, former Kremlin official Pavel Borodin. The photo has since been removed. Full unquote. And by the way, in terms of, you know, that some of the videos that are publicly released with Dugin in more recent years, including his video with the then non-deceased Daria Dugin, show him like, you know, trying to sort of, you know, semi-flirting really, like, you know, trying calling her beautiful and like, this is, you know, you are, I think in that interview that Dugin did with Dugina, it seemed like Dugina granted him the interview. And I remember him comparing and contrasting Russian women with American women, with a derogatory attitude toward American women, in relationship to, Dugina. So Dugin shows himself not only to be this, you know, the quote unquote disgruntled type, who's into, who knows, you know, tech enough to set up these secure dumping grounds for data, some of which puts out true and sometimes false information, but also a guy who's easily marked as a target for some kind of espionage honeypot operation by Russian women of all sorts, it seems like. All right, bottom of page 224. Of American Kompromat by Unger. Quote, up until this time, Dugin had vacillated between the worlds of a small-time huckster who created revenge fantasy websites laced with disinformation and a legitimate whistleblower decrying racism and corruption. Whether one thought Dugin was legit or a con man, everyone could all agree on one thing. In either case, in the context of world affairs, John Mark Dugin was small time, insignificant, a nobody. But the photo he posted on Facebook suggests something else entirely. Pavel Borodin is not a familiar name to Americans, but in Russia he's a major figure. In fact, he's so close to Vladimir Putin that one has to ask why one of the most important figures in Putin's inner circle would waste time lunching with Dugin. Quote, Borodin is no small fry, says Yuri Shvets. This is the guy who brought Putin to Moscow, to the Kremlin, unquote. Dubbed, quote-unquote, Putin's mentor by Time, Borodin had overseen the Presidential Affairs Department during the Boris Yeltsin administration in the 90s, and so was in charge of the upkeep of the Russian Federation's assets. And which of Russia's assets was he overseeing, you may ask? Actually, just about all of them. As the New York Times reported, Borodin had oversight of Russia's land, Russia's farms, Russia's dachas, I don't know how to pronounce that word, but that's the word that means like, compounds. Its automobiles, its aircraft, and its yachts. Russia's hospitals, Russia's buildings, its antiques, its art, and more. More than 200 profit-making companies. And he had oversight of things you might overlook because they didn't fit neatly into categories, such as a stake in a $12 billion Arctic diamond mine. All told, Borodin was in charge of supervising some $600 billion in assets, nearly $1 trillion in 2020 dollars. Quote, Mr. Borodin is unequivocally far and away the Russian that people would most love to bribe, unquote, the New York Times reported. Forget Russia, few people on earth have this much largesse at their fingertips, unquote. and even fewer people were in such a pivotal position at the birth of the untamed gangster capitalism in Russia and were able to do something that truly marked a turning point in world history. In 1996, at a time when efforts to develop a real market economy were failing and Russia was devolving into a mafia state, Borodin hired Putin as his deputy and put him in a vital strategic position that allowed him to broker the new rules of a nascent kleptocracy. The relationships between the oligarchs and the Kremlin and the rise of the mafia state. It has been widely speculated in the Russian media that if anyone has compromat on Putin, it would be Pavel Borodin from this period. And when the state prosecutor started investigating Borodin for his alleged role in a multi-million dollar bribery and money laundering scam, Putin, who had become FSB chief by this time, showed his great loyalty to Borodin by ousting the prosecutor, Yuri Skuratov, using secret footage that allegedly showed Skuratov cavorting with prostitutes. When Putin became president in 2000, he then gave Borodin the post of State Secretary of the Union of Russia and Belarus, a largely ceremonial position that had the highly valued perquisite of guaranteeing him legal immunity in Russia. Unquote. By the way, now that I would think in terms of what we've now seen in terms of the invasion of Ukraine and Belarus's role in supporting Russia in terms of that, and now the Wagner Prigozhin move to Belarus, and it is a launching point in relationship to much more global Russian operations. I would think that this position was potentially, had at the very least, has now become more than ceremonial, even though I think it's not Borodin anymore. All right, back to the text, page 226 of American Kompromat by Craig Unger. Quote, then in 2002, Borodin was convicted of money laundering by a Swiss court, and the Putin administration paid $3 million bail for his release. Immunity is a good thing to have when you have access to hundreds of billions of dollars. End of section. On to the next section. Quote, after Dugin's lunch with Borodin, a company called MD International Holdings put out a press release announcing that the company CEO, Mark Dugin, had traveled to Moscow, quote, to meet with Russian Secretary of State Pavel Borodin, unquote. In fact, Borodin was state secretary for the Russia-Belarus Union. The release added that, quote, Secretary Borodin presented Mr. Dugin with a very beautiful and very limited leather and gold book about the history of the Kremlin, as well as signing the book under his chapter in the book, unquote. The purpose of the meeting was said, quote, to establish a cooperation in various aspects of business, including facilitating American investments into the robust Russian business environment and to engage into markets that would be considered a single quote-unquote frontier to Russia, unquote. An internet search on the Wayback Machine suggests that MD International Holdings was not really a going concern and that its site may have been constructed for the sole purpose of publicizing Dugin's meeting with Borodin. So, what was a big fish like Borodin doing with a small fry like Dugin? According to Dugin, the meeting was perfectly innocent, and Borodin was just another Facebook friend. Quote, I wanted to start a business in Russia. I started looking at Facebook profiles and saw that this person was sitting in front of the Russian parliament, unquote, he told a Russian reporter. Quote, I added him as a friend and started chatting with him on Facebook. I asked him to meet. When you are American, it's easy to organize meetings with people, unquote. Sure. The man Vladimir Putin trusted to oversee more than $600 billion in assets was sitting around waiting for a former Palm Beach deputy to become his Facebook friend. That makes lots of sense.
It's kind of like the young college activist just randomly runs into the billionaire oil tycoon, Foster Freese, and gets him to bankroll his upstart activism company, organization turning point. That was what that reminded me of, the whole Charlie Kirk randomly running into this billionaire and selling him on why this is a good investment for him. Just reminds me of that. I mean, it just doesn't, it doesn't pass the smell test of it. That's like the randomness of it.
Agreed. Yeah. That's, I think that's a good parallel. Yeah. TP for your bunghole USA's Foster Freeze origin story. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Back to the text, page 227 of American Kompromat by Craig Unger. Quote, when I asked Yuri Shvets what he thought of Dugin's narrative, he laughed. Quote, it's like two needles meet each other in a haystack, he said. Pavel Borodin is searching Facebook, waiting until the guy comes from Florida to Moscow. This is what I would trust. The guy with a massive collection of video comes to Moscow and he gets in touch with Borodin and the FSB. That is what is happening. Dugin is in the selling business, unquote. And as for Borodin, he is in the buying business. Quote, Putin was a nobody until Borodin brought him to Moscow. So that means Borodin has direct contact with the Kremlin, with the FSB, unquote. According to Neil Barnett, Dugin presented himself as a ripe target for recruitment by the FSB, and his first trip to Moscow, quote, would have allowed Russian intelligence to fully recruit Dugin. It is likely that they presented the single quote-unquote cooperation as a way for them to support his campaign against PBSO, and that they slipped in requests relating to Epstein as an apparent afterthought or contextual matter, unquote. When he returned to Palm Beach, Dugin moved on to other matters. He continued to have a relationship with his Russian girlfriend for a period of time during which each of them made two or three trips between Moscow and Palm Beach. At the same time, he says, Joe Ricari continued to give him more documents from the Epstein investigation through 2015. Meanwhile, Dugin also escalated his war with the local powers that be. It became increasingly sophisticated. Over the next 3 years, he played email pranks on politicians, disseminated fake news, and created a website to show how to keep the FBI from accessing a computer. Full unquote. There are parameters here that might suggest that Dugin was already, as is suggested in this text, I think that Dugin was already working as an asset for Russian intelligence after the first time he had gone to Russia and met with Borodin and then returns to Florida, keeps in contact with his Russian quote unquote girlfriend, and then, you know, does things that are in realm of, I'm sorry to say this, but in realm with the Uhuru indictments in relationship to the question of Russian lines that are being pushed for different reasons. Now this one seems like it was a push, beginning the push of this much bigger 11-9 operation and the Trump quote unquote Russia part of it that included a major push into social media and into not only like lines of propaganda, but the dumping into the public mind more generally, in a way that they begin to disrupt, divide and conquer, and really do the kind of work of of hyper normalization of that idea of like the theater, the political theater warfare of Putin's gray cardinal. What's his name again, Greg? I can't remember.
Vladislav Surkov.
So you begin to I think it's important to understand that what Surkov had deployed for Putin domestically in Russia was then made its way very intensely with an escalation, especially toward things like Brexit and the 11-9 operation, the Trump operation in the United States as it began to approach, in a way that was way more related to Russian hybrid warfare abroad, right? So I think that's a key to understand here in terms of context.
And also makes me wonder, like, Dugin, whatever intentions he started out in terms of his legitimate grievances that he may have had with the way things were being conducted in Palm Beach County, and as well as American law enforcement in general. You have to wonder, like, especially after he makes this trip to Russia, links up with this Russian woman, and all these other things that go on, the direct interconnecting with Borodin, et cetera, that does he start to become, is it designed in this area that is full of foreign influence, South Florida, just a lot of big moneyed, obviously foreign influence and important things going on down there. Does he just start using his services to perhaps start targeting certain people within these, you know, that maybe it just becomes like a way to monitor and keep track of it at the very, and go after certain people that might be, and I wonder about that, if it just becomes like a way to just go after specific people that maybe are seen as inconvenient to things that might be going on. I'm not sure, but I would think that it would be a logical question to ask if, like, Dugan's work just starts to go in the directions of certain people, maybe placing more of a microscope or a target on specific individuals. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that we should pay attention to that. All right, back to the very top of page 228 of American Compromise by Craig Unger. Quote, he played email pranks on politicians. This is Dugan. Disseminated fake news and created a website to show how to keep the FBI from accessing a computer. Quote, he became adept at creating fake news sites to propagate false stories, said Barnett. He also apparently worked out how to reverse engineer access to confidential data, which he then released in order to cause maximum damage. It appears that he benefited from the assistance of more sophisticated people, unquote. But in his book about his adventures, Bad Wolf, Dugan insists that he is not an asset of the Russian government, nor has it tried to recruit him. In an interview with the Daily Mail, Dugan also asserted that he has not shared any materials with the Russian government and that he does not intend to blackmail anyone with his information. End of section. On to the next section. Quote, by March 2016, however, Dugan's massive doxing rampage had apparently gone too far. Early in the morning of March 14th, 2016, Dugan woke up and fed breakfast to his two kids as they prepared for school. As Dugan himself describes it in Bad Wolf, at the front door, he noticed a black Ford FX2 pickup truck idling in front of his house. The pickup had black tinted windows, which are illegal in Florida, and suggested to him that the truck was an undercover vehicle. Dugan went back indoors, put on a shirt, and went outside to see what they were doing. The truck's doors opened. FBI agents wearing tactical vests burst out. Agents started coming out of the bushes behind buildings everywhere. Within moments, Dugan was cuffed and on the ground. One agent immediately grabbed Dugan's cell phone and passed it to another, quote, presumably because they knew my phone was encrypted and had to act fast to ensure they could suck all the data out of it before it locked, unquote. Before long, the FBI began wheeling in machinery, which Dugan surmised had, quote, portable batteries and an inverter that would enable the FBI to keep the computer running while they unplugged it. That way they could extrapolate the encryption key at a later date, unquote. One of the agents asked, quote, who are your Russian friends? You should tell us because it's going to be a lot easier if you tell us what we want to know, unquote. They seized his passport and put him on the no-fly list, so no commercial air travel or private travel outside the country was possible. The raid, he said, was, quote, the most significant holy shit moment of my life, unquote. As for the so-called Epstein videos, what about them? According to Dugan, when the FBI seized his computers in 2016, they got everything Ricari had given him. If Dugan's videos were the real deal, that meant that the FBI had possession of Jeffrey Epstein's prize compromat, and with it, the secrets of the most powerful men in the world. When the FBI finally left and had not arrested him, Dugan knew his troubles weren't over. So 9 days later, on March 23, 2016, he went down to Isla Morada Key in South Florida, about 150 miles south of Palm Beach, and rented an 18-foot boat from Bud and Mary's marina. He intended not to return the boat, but instead to embark on a spectacularly dangerous 300-mile trip to Cuba on the, quote, barely buoyant shitbox, unquote, as he referred to it. Before he took off, however, Dugan noticed a handful of FBI agents at the marina on his tail. Dugan immediately realized that meant even if he were able to survive the stormy seas, the FBI would have Homeland Security or the Coast Guard on him in no time. That meant it was on to Plan B. Now that he realized he was still under such intense surveillance, Dugan deactivated all his mobile devices, including a burner phone he had bought. In Bad Wolf, Dugan's account of what happened next as he escaped from the United States is brief, but it is full of holes. Quote, a few days after I left the marina, he writes, I donned a blonde wig on my bald head and a pair of light prescription glasses, evading capture by the FBI and fleeing the United States. After renting a small plane and faking a medical emergency to slip into Canada, I made my way to Toronto. I flew Turkish Airlines to Moscow, where I became the fourth American in history to obtain political asylum in Russia, unquote. Before Dugan, Edward Snowden had been the most recent. He arrived in Russia on April 6 or 7, he told me, and applied for asylum a few days later. Quote, it took a few days for me to get my head on straight and apply for asylum, unquote. According to Barnett, Dugan's departure from the United States bore all the hallmarks of, quote, a professional exfiltration plan put together by an intelligence service. First, Dugan got a car with no documented connection to him and drove it to the Canadian border. He then chartered a light aircraft to overfly Canada. During the flight, he claimed he was having a heart attack and then ran off when the pilot made an emergency landing. From Toronto, he bought a ticket to Istanbul, and from Istanbul, bought a new ticket to Moscow, unquote. And why Moscow? Quote, there are very few governments around the world that the U.S. won't mess with, and that the U.S. can't somehow strong-arm into returning a political dissident, unquote, he told a Russian reporter. Quote, Russia happens to be one of them, and I can't think of another government that's more powerful that would protect me, unquote. And indeed, on arrival, Dugan was granted temporary asylum in Russia, which was later changed to permanent status. When I talked to him, he added a rhetorical question. Quote, where else am I going to go that my country can't extradite me back? You've got North Korea, you've got Africa, China, forget it. I like this country very much, unquote. And what about the kompromat? In confiscating Dugan's computers, the FBI and the PBSO now presumably had copies of the Epstein videos that Dugan says Ricari had brought to him for safekeeping. Dugan told me he had paid scant attention to the files Ricari had left with him. And on the rare occasion when he opened a video file, all he saw was a footage of an empty room with coverage from an old-fashioned low-resolution closed-circuit TV camera. Quote, you have to remember in those days, CCTV was poor quality and some of the earlier files had the telltale signs that they were burned to the discs from VHS tapes, unquote. When I asked if I could see any of the files, he demurred and said he was not going to broadcast child pornography over the internet. Because the tape sessions regularly began with the camera surveying an empty room, Dugan says, he never saw any activity and assumed they were ordinary surveillance videos. Nevertheless, he told me that he knew the files were about Epstein, so he made an extra set, which would have made him an extraordinarily valuable asset to the Russians. Quote, if Dugan really has these videotapes, they would be priceless, said Yuri Shvets. Hundreds of videotapes of famous people in the United States with underage girls, it's hardcore kompromat, unquote. Because of their value, Dugan claims he took extraordinary precautions. Quote, the FBI and other intelligence agencies may be surprised to have discovered that I kept an off-site backup that was sent to me in 2017 after I was safely established in Russia, unquote. Initially, he says, he put all the Epstein videos into a TrueCrypt container, which moved from server to server over the years as insurance that the data would stay fresh and safe from data loss. When TrueCrypt discontinued its software in 2014, Dugin switched to VeraCrypt and rotated encrypted backups on a regular basis. Later, he says, he distributed the data to unidentified contacts who did not know each other and who lived on five different continents and are unable to read the files because they do not have the decryption keys. Quote, I do not have a physical copy in my immediate possession because of security reasons, he told me. This is to make sure my family and friends remain safe. I have made arrangements that it can only be decrypted in the event of my arrest, if I go missing for an extended time, or in case of my unusual or untimely demise. I have a system in place to connect people with the encrypted containers to those who have the decryption keys. According to the Daily Mail, quote, Dugin, who said he has received death threats since fleeing the United States, added that he had no intention of ever revealing the content stored on encrypted drives. Quote, I'm not going to reveal them and I'm not going to blackmail anyone. If I give them up, then I lose all my leverage and I do not want that to happen, unquote, full unquote. In other words, the kompromat was perfectly safe. Unless, of course, the FBI, the Palm Beach Sheriff's Office, Ghislaine Maxwell, or some other identified parties could break the codes. And, of course, there was the question of whether Dugin had made a deal with the FSB. For all the indications that he may be a con man or an eccentric in Britain, MI6 was taking Dugin very seriously, indeed, as someone who may be working directly with Russian intelligence. The chief reason, the Daily Mail reported in September 2019, had to do with his meeting with Pavel Borodin. The paper cited a Western intelligence source saying that Dugin had all the classic traits that made him vulnerable to recruitment by, quote, a hostile intelligence service, unquote. It also noted that, quote, his knowledge of the Epstein case would have been of great interest to Russian intelligence, unquote. But the fate of the kompromat remained uncertain. Full unquote. End of chapter 15 of American Kompromat by Craig Unger.
All right. Well, I'm glad to get the details filled in on the Dugin situation. And I mean, we've talked about this, that it's, I mean, it's, I mean, it's kind of where, to me, it seems kind of implausible that there would be people in Russia that wouldn't know, like, especially with the stakes and how consequential it is of, like, of the details of this. You know, maybe this is, but it's kind of hard to believe that there are people who wouldn't know, like, or at least wouldn't know of, like, or have, like, a understanding of some of the content with what's at stake and the prospects that would have for as we're talking about the word of the book kompromat and all that. It's, you know, I kind of have a hard time believing there would be people related to Borodin or maybe other people around there in the Russian realm who wouldn't at least, like, know of some things that are in this possession that would be of this type of importance and this type of leverage in terms of public figures and all this and what the consequences of that would be.
And remember too, it's interesting that there, even without Dugin, there were already prior existing these very sort of interesting Soviet-tied, connections here, including a former Soviet Special Forces guy who came to the United States, who was involved in things like mixed martial arts, who became Epstein's driver and body man, total security guy.
Name's escaping me, but I remember we talked about him.
Yes, Zinoviev, I believe.
Zinoviev, that's the correct name. Yes, you're right about that. Yeah, he was, yep.
And then,
so he had to train a lot of stars, celebrities, actors, news people, et cetera, at his gym.
And that's who was Epstein's body man, driver, security, total security guy, during the years where he was, after he was first arrested and then had this real sweetheart deal where he basically left, you know, left prison many days and was able to work from home while he was serving out something barely over a year or something like that. And this was this former Soviet Special Forces guy, Zinoviev, I believe was his body man during that time. And then also the background of the research of Josh, what's his name again, Greg? Josh, who did the Secret History of the American Right.
Josh Reeves.
Josh Reeves, who...
Yeah, a documentary Alex Jones never made, yeah.
Yeah, and who Josh Reeves, who brought to the surface this deep connection between Epstein Maxwell and the what was known as the Russian James Bond, Doronin, who was the boyfriend, built a massive property for international model superstar Naomi Campbell, who was deeply connected to the Epstein Maxwell organization. And Doronin's company, ultimately Aman Resorts, I think, became... It may have been after it passed out of his hands, I think, but it was the became the retrofitter of the Lolita Island Epstein property in Little St. James. So there were all these, you know, there's these pre-existing or parallel kinds of questions that relate to the question of the Russian sphere and Russian intelligence. In addition, obviously, to now what does U.S. intelligence have in its hands in terms of the original Epstein arrests, and then the second Epstein arrest and trial, and then the Ghislaine Maxwell arrest, indictment, and guilty conviction.
Go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say, and then you pointed out, even going back, this might even be pre-Epstein, but what you would point out that would just completely go over someone like Kevin Barrett's head on back when you were, back when we were still involved with that whole network of people. The TVs that were supplied to the Trump properties by Semyon Sam Kislin, and the potential for material to be recorded and all of this and uploaded. And this would be, of course, at the time when Trump, the mogul, was having just Russian mobsters just constantly using his properties basically as for money laundering and all of this, the likes of Mogilevich's man, Bogatin, people like that, and just you would bring that up, and I think that's also something to figure in here in terms of like the KGB intelligence operations that may or may not have meant something, but at the very least, like, it's something that should be certainly considered in this regard, is the nature of these compromising types of tapes and things like this taking place as early as the 1980s at properties owned by Donald Trump, among other things.
Definitely. And that is then the I think that's really important that you brought in that earlier. That's the earlier generation, really, you would think of one generation earlier of potential kompromat information that appeared to be brokered amongst the pre-existing Trump operation and people like Semyon Kislin, Sam Kislin, very also tied into Rudy Giuliani's politics in New York City during the 80s, but also then Tamir Sapir. They sold, I think, 200 TV sets in 1976 for Trump's Commodore Hotel. And then there's a whole background there in terms of long-term kompromat operations that then you sort of come back from Florida into New York City, the locus of the United Nations. Remember Netanyahu's role at the United Nations on behalf of Israel during these key 80s, which is also then the time of the Jonathan Pollard, the Soviet Israeli spy operation there, and Netanyahu's closing in with his connections with the Trumps, it looks like, especially during Netanyahu's time in New York City, which comes in the immediate wake of these even earlier very likely Soviet intelligence operations in terms of electronic stores and Trump properties.
All this going on while basically then prosecutor Rudolph Giuliani is working to targeting some of the primary Italian mafia syndicates in New York City, and ultimately the ushering out for the Russian emigres and all this, all going on in this mid to late 80s time period. And that's very, I think, all interconnects in ways that are pretty significant, probably.
All right. Well, very good. And there's a lot more, obviously, to dig up in terms of especially the history of Pavel Borodin and how he's this key figure that indicates something much deeper and bigger going on around Dugin than it looks, what at least what he says on the surface, especially in terms of the Epstein Maxwell compromat material and who all has it and all of that. And then also you could use Borodin as a key figure in re-understanding Putin's background and his rise to power to the head, the long-term head of this very specific, you know, Russian security / mafia state. But for now, I guess we'll leave. This is sort of a good closing chapter to this question of John Mark Dugin and the question of who has the compromat in terms of this specific part of the story. And we'll begin moving on to some other pressing realms, I'd say, next time.
All right, sounds good. We'll be back very soon to get into something else, and we'll, you know, figure out what we're going to cover next, and we'll get into it. But thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you, Greg. And thank you to all of you, our listeners and our supporters. We appreciate you. Until next time, Antidote, we are out.